Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
This is the Savage Nation. Obama is a consummate salesman. But guess what? He's already sold the healthcare bill. Now he's taking back the sale by going out and selling it again because he's trying to change the subject. But the people aren't buying it, by the way. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. I guess we're talking about Obama's dangerous inexperience. I guess we're talking about the shocking incompetence of this administration. And I guess we're asking ourselves, how did they get away with it? The man is running around like a child with someone else's credit cards, bankrupting his parents' accounts. It's unbelievable. How in the world does anyone think this is going to end? The man is using our tax dollars going forward 50 years as though it's his private bank. He's trampling on our nation's treasury in a way that exceeds all of the presidents that have preceded him. He is like King Ludwig II of Bavaria, for those of you who have read the history of King Ludwig II of Bavaria. Remember, Obama was never a businessman. All he did was go to Harvard on affirmative action, and they gave him the Harvard Law Review as a plum in order to make him look even better. Nobody ever said no to Obama, ever. He has had no criticism in his life. Do you understand that? Does anyone really understand who this man is? The skids were greased for him from the time he was a child. Everybody said yes to him. Nobody said no. Nobody ever criticized him. He does not do well with criticism. And so he always evades and changes the subject. The U.S. Marines are called Leathernecks for a reason. And the reason is the U.S. Navy was created to fight pirates, again, Muslim pirates at that. In the early 1800s, we had no navy, but we had merchant ships. We were a young nation, lots of trade going on. We had ships going into that dangerous area, and pirates from Africa would raid the merchant ships and kill the crews and take the cargo. So the merchants of early America demanded that the government help them. And unlike the government of today, the government created the U.S. Navy to help the merchants. The Navy was a warship. It was very fast. It was ironclad. And it had men on it called U.S. Marines. They were on the ship to fight the pirates with swords and flintlocks. And they had leather necks put on their necks, swaths of leather, to protect their necks against the pirates' sword blows. The thing is, though, when they caught pirates, they didn't bring them back to Boston or Washington for a trial. They gutted them and threw them to the sharks. It definitely eliminated piracy in the seas. How have we devolved to such a point that we have the most powerful navy on the earth with people running it who are afraid to fire a shot? Answer. Well, the answer is there is no answer. There is no answer. Certain things there's no answer to. So Obama wants to kick some ass for the oil spill. We all know that he failed us. We all know that it's his disaster. We know he owns it, which is why he is on the road selling health care again. Everything that was done with the Gulf oil spill by the Obama administration has been wrong. Initially, Team Obama wanted to keep this problem away from the president. It took Obama 12 days to show up in the region. Democrats criticized Bush for waiting 4 days after Katrina to go to New Orleans, right? Let's talk about the strategy of barrier berms. These temporary sand islands block the flow of oil into fragile wetlands and marshes. But berm construction requires approval from the Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Louisiana officials asked permission to build these berms on May 11th. They did not hear back because the feds were conducting environmental reviews while the oil was washing ashore, killing the sea life. The dispersants were not used properly. The federal government was even slower in the question of dispersants. Those are chemicals used to break up the oil and hasten its evaporation from the surface of the water. Again, they failed on that. Yes, the Gulf spill is Obama's Katrina. There's no question about it. And the president's dangerous inexperience is coming home to roost. There's a very well-written article on this subject by Byron York, and I would like to summarize some of the failures of Obama. Washington Examiner Byron York: spill reveals Obama's lack of experience, and we mean lack of executive experience. I want to read you the first paragraph. In mid-February 2008, fresh from winning a bunch of Super Tuesday primaries, Barack Obama granted an interview to 60 Minutes correspondent Steve Croft. "When you sit down and look at your resume," Croft said to Obama, "there's no executive experience. And in fact, correct me if I'm wrong, the only thing that you've actually run was the Harvard Law Review." "Well, I've run my Senate office and I've run this campaign," Obama said. 7 months after receiving the Democrat presidential nomination, Obama talked with CNN. At the time, the news was dominated by Hurricane Gustav, which was headed towards New Orleans and threatening to become a Katrina-like disaster. CNN said, "Some of your Republican critics have said you don't have the experience to handle a situation like this. They, in fact, have said that Governor Palin has more executive experience than you." Obama answered, "Governor Palin's town of Wasilla has, I think, 50 employees. We have got 2,500 in this campaign. I think their budget is maybe $12 million a year. You know, we have a budget of about three times that just for the month. So I think that our ability to manage large systems and to execute, has been made clear over the last couple of years," said Obama. Obama ignored Palin's experience as governor of Alaska, which was considerably bigger than the Obama campaign. But Obama's point was clear. "If you're worried about my lack of executive experience, look at my campaign. Running a first-rate campaign," you see, he thought that running a campaign was like running a country. 1-800-449-8255. What can you say that has not been said so far? Fact of the matter is, Obama is not up to the job. And if he had any honor, he would retire. He would quit and he would let more competent people take over this job. That's what he would do for the sake of America. But you know that that is never going to happen. And by the way, if you look at how the government has mishandled this disaster, I want to ask you something. How do you think they would handle a dirty bomb in New York City? Do you think they would do a better job on that? Do you think that this government is able to protect you from Al-Qaeda or one of the other terrorist groups if they wanted to set off a bomb in Times Square? Do you think they would know how to deal with that disaster any more than they know how to deal with the disaster in the Gulf? So what are you looking forward to in the future under Obama? What do you think is going to happen in this country in 1 year, in 2 years, in 3 years? Remember, he's young yet, and he's just done his first victory lap. He's just done his first victory lap. What do you think is going to happen after lap number two, lap number three, lap number four? Will it be a benign European-style socialist nation? Will it be something more sinister along the lines of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, with the middle class being driven out of America with their property seized by the government? Or will it fall into a total fascist state of socialism along the lines of some of the fascist socialist states that have existed in the last century and exist right now? That's simple. It certainly isn't going to be the America that your father grew up in. It's certainly not going to be an America where hard work got you somewhere. And we know all of that. So what do you think is coming to this country? Many people are frightened of this man. And they're rightly frightened of this man. They're rightly frightened.
Savage.
I'm going to make a commitment today on the Savage Nation to avoid anything that is within the alimentary canal from the front to the end. We will nothing to do with anything to do with the alimentary canal for the moment. I'm going to talk about cars, classic cars. I went to a classic car show. I'm more or less a recluse, as you well know. I pride myself on reclusiveness. Now, there are younger guys who are hungry, and they need to make a buck, and they're everywhere. They're the Zelligs of the media. Wherever you turn, there they are. This Tea Party, that Tea Party. It's important stuff. Everywhere you turn, Fox News, CNN, Bill Markowitz's show, everywhere you turn, there are Zelligs in the media appearing every day in every way. Now, that's fine. I don't do it. I never like to do it, and I don't want to do it. So I basically stay in my house in pajamas, except for the occasional bicycle ride or the occasional car show or the miserable trip to a restaurant, which I always regret. Now, there's a secondary note to all of this talking here on the Savage Nation. I stayed in bed most of the weekend, and I feel great. My mind feels better. I feel calmer. I can think. So I went to a car show, the Marin Sonoma Classic Car Show out in the Marin, where was it? An outdoor thing. And I was astounded at the love for vehicles that I saw there, including my own. I mean, I can remember the cars that were there. Some of them, the Duesenbergs, the 59 Vet, the Mercedes-Benz 300 SLs, the Bentley Continental from 1961, the Pierce Arrows, the 56 Continental, the 56 T-Bird. I mean, see, if I just mention the names of these cars to most of you, they actually symbolize to you various images come to your mind. And if I say to you I saw the most amazingly beautiful 1957 Chrysler 300D and I couldn't take my eyes off it, you'll understand what I'm saying. But, you know, it's funny. Of all the cars I saw there, I had a friend I ran into, an old mechanic friend of mine. He used to fix my old Jaguars, which always broke down. He took a picture of me in front of one car. I only asked him to take a picture of me and Teddy in front of one car. It was a Model T Ford Roadster. It was so beautiful. And I wanted to picture myself in front of the Model T only because I used to build them out of plastic when I was a kid. And it just reminded me. I remember the hard rubber wheels. It all came back to me. But what I'm getting at was the crowd at the auto show. And I was thinking about a few things as I walked around looking at these stunningly gorgeous cars. I could not get out of my head, what would the Obamaites be thinking? That's all I was thinking. What would these hardcore leftist freaks in the White House think of a classic car show such as the one I went to over the weekend? And all I could think about was these mean monsters from Harvard. These undereducated pinheads would sort of not only look down upon classic car shows such as this, but that in the future they might ban this sort of show because the cars were not green enough, or that only people with money could afford cars like this. And I started thinking as I walked around looking at these incredible classic cars, what do you think it is about car shows that angers progressives? And then I was going to ask you, do you still have a love affair with cars, or are they just box transportation to you? And then I was going to say, what does the way a person takes care of their car say about their politics? And do liberals drive differently than conservatives? I can say for sure. Genuinely, when I'm cut off, it's a lame brain with an Obama bumper sticker from the right lane. One after the other, and it's usually older women who have been disappointed in life. Either their husbands left them or they were never married, whatever it is. They generally still drive around with the Obama, you know, for president bumper sticker in some kind of econo box, and they usually try to cut you off in the right lane, and when you don't let them in, they get furious. Like, we have merging lanes in certain parts of the area where I live. Inevitably, they know the right lane merges into the left, they know it's coming to a dead end, and it's always the, quote, nice liberals who try to speed up in the right lane. And I don't know, I won't let them in. I won't let them in. I'm a very competitive person. I don't like being cut off. So I give Wilhelm the gas, and Wilhelm gives them the fume, and they get cut off to the, you know, like, screw you. I mean, what do you mean? You're going to cut me off because you're a nice person? Because you have an Obama bumper sticker? So the cars, you know, you want to talk about cars. I don't know if you want to talk about it. You want me to get into the whole politics? Obama signs a Freedom of Press Act and takes no questions from the press. Hello? That is why I'd rather talk about Janis Joplin's psychedelic theme 1965 Porsche 356 Cabriolet. I have never been a Porsche fan. I never owned one. I never wanted to own one. I don't know what it is. Maybe the Nazi thing. I don't really know. It can't be the Nazi thing because I own a Mercedes, and that was so long ago. Who cares anyway? I mean, I love Mercedes-Benz. It's the best car I ever owned in my life. It's all I drive. I told you I have fancy cars, and I have unfancy cars. My daily driver is a 600S, an S600 Mercedes. I gave it a name, Wilhelm. I don't drive around saying Wilhelm. I don't talk to it. I'm generally either driving or talking to my dog, Teddy. But the fact of the matter is, after I got this car, I never, ever needed a sports-type car. And I do own a Ferrari, a 430. I rarely, if ever, drive it. But the funny thing is that after I saw the Testarossa and the other Ferraris at the fairgrounds yesterday, actually, even though it was cloudy and horrible and miserable weather, I went all the way to a garage where I keep it, took the cover off it, and took the Ferrari for a drive because the color itself, the Ferrari red in the gray, was astoundingly beautiful. But I'm not one of these guys with the top down making believe I'm enjoying the sun. I don't know. I still don't understand that part of it. Do you? I can't understand it. Whenever there's a hot, sunny day, you see people with the top down. They're enjoying the sun. And I ask myself, did they go to the fifth grade? Did they don't understand the relationship between the sun and skin cancer, especially amongst white men over the age of 13? I mean, what are they thinking? A convertible's nice for a night, a warm, balmy night in Miami, but not for the day. What do you need sun on your face for? It's to show off. That's all it is. Now, who in this day and age thinks anyone who drives around in a convertible is rich or a celebrity? Does anyone, can you answer that question? Most of the so-called loser celebrities in Hollywood drive Priuses anyway. I know that for a fact because I go to L.A. an awful lot. They wouldn't be seen dead in a new car other than a some kind of hybrid. You know, hybrid. All the lowbrows are in hybrids. I love that one. But that's it. I mean, there's a lot to be said for a Rolls Royce. A Rolls Royce in this economy? Yeah. Hello. Yes, if a man earned the money and he bought a Rolls Royce and he loves the Rolls Royce, who are you to tell him he can't drive the Rolls Royce? He's paid a gas guzzler tax. That's not enough, though, for Cass Sunstein from Harvard, whose father taught him over a seltzer and corned beef how to take over the world with lies, in my humble opinion. I'm so sick of these communists, you have no idea. That's why I don't want to talk about them. I don't want to even dignify these communists from Harvard, these losers who have never created a product or a service that anybody wants. That's why I went to the car show. Anyway, we could talk about anything you want here. All right, I'll be right back.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
You want me to tell you what happened at the museum, a night at the museum? I'm not sure you want to hear about the exhibit, the closed. It had never been open to the public, Birth of Impressionism. So I went. I was invited because I happen to love Impressionist paintings. Who doesn't? We all grew up on them. I mean, everybody grew up on Impressionist paintings. Everybody who went to college had to study the Impressionists, right? And so many of you say, ah, that's passe. We don't look at it anymore. Who needs it? We know all about it. You don't know all about it. In fact, I went there and found three new paintings that I didn't know existed. I take that back. I did know they existed. One of them I knew existed. The Floor Scrapers from 1875 by Calabot. Unbelievable. Raboteurs de Parquet, to show you I know French. The Magpie by Monet, 1868. And then most important to me, which was the painting that was very political, The Escape of Rochefort by Manet. Now, why did that painting have any relevance for me? The Escape of Rochefort. I'm going to read this to you for 1 minute, and then we'll move on to straight politics. But I want to read this to you. It caught me. It's basically a picture of a sea. And in the midst of this big painting of a sea, there's a small picture of men in a rowboat. And you read it. Edouard Manet, The Escape of Rochefort. 1881. And just listen to the paragraph. It doesn't matter whether you went to college or not. Henri Rochefort founded the controversial political journal La Lantern, The Lantern, and was actively opposed to the imperial regime of Napoleon III. Sounds like Obama I, doesn't it? This led to his involvement in the Paris Commune, for which he was imprisoned. Press freedom, anyone? Manet depicts Rochefort's daring escape from a French prison colony in New Caledonia. Intended for the Salon of 1881, Manet's political commentary transforms the recent past into modern history. Amen, does it ever. It's interesting to me that they didn't kill political opponents. They didn't send out Secret Service agents or secret agents to spy on them. Well, they arrested them and they, you know, excommunicated them, in this case, the New Caledonia, which you have to understand how far away New Caledonia is and how far away New Caledonia was from Paris in the 1880s. If you've been to any part of the South Pacific, you realize it may as well be the end of the world. That he escaped is astounding. But that brings us front and center to today, which is the art of today. Art of today, from the political, it's become the polemical. I'm going to ask you a simple question. You don't have to be educated. You don't have to like art to answer this question, right? Here's the question. Can you name one artist in the United States of America? Name one. You can't. Can you name any artist from France who speaks today for France? Can you name one German artist? No, you don't know of any because there are none. It doesn't mean there aren't people who are painting, there aren't people who are sculpting, there are. But there are no prominent artists in any Western nation. So you say, wait a minute, how did this happen? How did we wind up in a place where there are no artists that we know of? How come we don't know of an artist in America? Can you name one scientist in America? You can't. How come there's not one prominent scientist? In other words, if you look back 50 years, you all heard of Jonas Salk. You heard of a physicist named Albert Einstein. You know what I'm saying? The giants. How come there are no giants in the sciences, the arts today? There's an answer to that as well. In my opinion, I have the answer for that. It has to do with liberalism. Liberalism deconstructed the entire West, all of Western civilization, and destroyed it. And the reason they deconstructed Western civilization is to enable themselves to reconstruct it in the image of a gigantic new Sovietized world where there is no art except art which serves the state. Witness the Obama posters during the campaign, where there is no science other than science which supports the government. Do you follow what I'm saying to you? You have to understand where I'm coming from to understand what I'm saying at all. So I attended an art show at the De Young Museum, classical paintings from the Impressionist era, and I was again taken in by their beauty. But I ask you, where in America today are such works of art being created? Can you name one artist today that creates works of art on the level of a Degas or Renoir? Well, what's amazing is that even the art of that era was sometimes political, as I just showed you. But in the world of art, we've gone from the political to the polemical. Can you think of a single artist today whose art is intended to uplift instead of to offend? Can you think of an artist who describes instead of degrades? Can you think of an artist who reveres instead of reviles America? There's no one. No Western nation currently produces great artists or sculptors, and it's because of the same left-wing ism that has destroyed our political system. The very same left that would laud a loser like Woody Allen, who wishes that there would be a dictatorship where Obama could be a dictator if it wasn't for those nasty Republicans. This is from a Jew. This is from a liberal Jew who wishes for a dictatorship. This is why I've told you years ago that you actually shouldn't fear these people. You should pity them. Liberalism is a mental disorder, a very serious one. What Woody Allen doesn't know is that when the Nazis rose to power in Germany, and that was a dictatorship, I guess that was a bad dictatorship. It certainly was, but to Woody Allen, there was only one bad dictatorship. That was that of Nazi Germany. But I guess the Soviet Union had a good dictatorship under Stalin. Now, what did the Germans do? The Nazis took many of the great works of art, which they considered to be degenerate, and removed them from museums, particularly the art of Jews. They took away the art of Chagall, Kandinsky, and they removed them from public view, but they didn't destroy them. No, did they? Not at all. Ironically, those paintings and many other classical works of art were stolen and hoarded by high-ranking officials of the Nazi regime. Now, what happened in Russia is after the Russian Revolution, the Bolsheviks tried to put all art into the service of the dictatorship of the proletariat. Stalin issued a decree, quote, on the reconstruction of literary and art organizations, and only art in the, quote, socialist realism style was allowed. What does this have to do with America today? Well, listen, the Nazis and the Soviets were both socialist regimes. Never be deceived. We know the Soviets were socialist, that you know, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republic. But you didn't know that the Nazis were socialist until I told you this 4 years ago. And they allowed only art that fell in line with their extreme political agenda. And what did they do? They depicted muscled factory workers and overalls struggling in a steel foundry, or heroic visions of soldiers hearkening back to the Roman Empire. These paintings, posters, and sculptures were propaganda, not real art. And so you go even to China under Mao Zedong. Remember the peasant posters of the noble peasant working in the field? Again, that's an example of state-sponsored art. And what's happening today? That's the real question. Well, what's happening today is that real art has been hollowed out and replaced with garbage that serves the needs of the state. Do you realize that great art is by its very nature conservative? That crap art is by its very nature liberal? A great painting conserves a moment in time or an emotion so that it can be experienced by future generations. The conservative bees build up the hive. The progressive termites tear down the hive. They critique art, they impose meanings upon it that are designed to further their far-left political agendas. And so the art that is created by leftists is destructive. For example, a painting of the Virgin Mary in elephant dung, a crucifix in a jar of urine, or a mindless repetition of images such as Andy Warhol's soup cans. Why was that designed? What is it designed for? Well, all of those pieces of dreck were designed to render the very structure of art meaningless. Remember, the goal of liberal, postmodern, deconstructive art is to tear down the old institutions like the Catholic Church, the family, the nation, and replace them with chaos. And then in that chaos, there is an environment ripe for takeover by a monolithic dictatorial view of culture in which only one opinion on an issue is allowed, and that is the opinion of the government. And in the world of art, this means giant posters of the great leader mounted on every empty wall, as we saw with the Obama posters that appeared in 2008. In the political world, it means a dictatorship, the kind of dictatorship that Woody Allen and other so-called members of the progressive art community wish Obama had. The left has deconstructed art, and now the left is trying to deconstruct our nation as well.
Savage.
She's real fine, my 409. She's real fine, my 409, my 409. Well, I save my pennies and I save my dimes. Giddy up, 409.
So I go to the car show, the classic car show. My favorite, actually, there's a number of favorites, a 57 Chrysler 300D. Unbelievable. The big Hemi engine with the twin carbs, twin four-barrel carbs. I say to my friend Alan, are they hard to keep together? He said, no, not at all. He said, he's a mechanic who's done this for 40, 50 years. I don't know how long. He said, no, they're very easy to maintain. He said, these older cars are very easy to maintain. They were much easier than the new ones. There was a 49 CAD convertible, a light green. Oh, my God, I love that car. I really always wanted like a 53 Caddy convertible. I mean, I could buy one, but I don't, because it's just more to take care of. But I realized my love affair with engines and cars and why liberals hate them. Why do liberals hate, for example, Indy, the Indy 500? Why do they hate stock car racing? Why do they hate everything to do with cars? Well, there's a number of reasons. One, let's stick to the classic car. The reason libs hate classic car shows is they represent two things that libs detest. They represent affluence, that you have enough money to maintain a car like this, and you take pleasure in showing it to somebody. That's number one. That's so unliberal. And number two, freedom. It represents the freedom to do what the hell you want with your money, not send it to Indonesia after an earthquake, for example. Like, you know, let the government take care of it. It's not my problem. Stop demanding I take care of the whole world. I really don't care about the whole world. I'd rather buy a 1957 Chrysler 300D, if you don't mind. And then, of course, it's the green thing, you know, the big greens, the liars. They fly all over the world to protest a little too much, as far as I am concerned. Anyway, here we are. Here we are. You have the biggest environmental disaster in history. Where is FEMA? Where is the Federal Emergency Management Agency? Has anyone heard from the manager of FEMA? The answer is no. And where is the Department of Homeland Security? Remember what Big Sis Napolitano said a few months ago? That terrorism is not the department's number one priority, but that an environmental disaster would be her number one priority? Where is she? Bowling somewhere with Janet Reno? Nobody knows where she is. What the hell is going on with this administration under Obama? Obama failed in this case from top to bottom. He failed to show up in the Gulf until 12 days after the rig blew up. He was nowhere in the early days of the spill. The federal government took no action in the first God knows how many days. Obama's federal agencies were slow to use dispersant chemicals to break up the oil. Obama failed to mobilize enough boats to deploy booms and containment devices and left it up to local officials. Obama failed by insisting this was BP's problem. The spill happened in U.S. waters. Obama could have used the military to help. He did not. Obama rejected the offers of Japan, France, China, and Russia, even though these nations have deep-sea submarines and robots that can work a mile under the ocean. Obama failed to erect barrier berms. If Obama had done half of these things, he might have prevented the worst environmental disaster in history. Even John McShane, with all his hemming and hawing, would have gotten angry and demanded immediate action from his subordinates. But because Obama knows how to run a campaign but not a government, this disaster has been the result. You must read the article, Poof Goes the Myth About Obama, by Jennifer Rubin. And she quotes Stuart Gottlieb of Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs, where he writes, "From the earliest days of the campaign, the Obama movement contained two political time bombs. First, the curse of absurdly high expectations." Well, blame us for that. We're going to change America, then we're going to change the world. "And second, electing to office a president with no governing or leadership experience. And now the chickens are also coming home to roost on a leadership incompetency question. The White House is continually slow off the mark, reactive, defensive, and unsure of its footing. It appears it is over its head. It will be difficult, if not impossible, to rebuild the Obama brand because it never really existed as a tangible thing in the first place." In other words, you were conned. You were conned. You were conned. Welcome to reality. Reality. A reality shot. You get it every day in the Savage Nation. Why does Karzai continue to wear that Boy Scout cap? I don't get it. What is that Cub Scout uniform? You know, that's so, like, third world outfitty. I mean, we know he's the president of a third world nation. Let's talk about Afghanistan for a minute now that I got your attention. I'm glad I got your attention. Can anyone explain to me why are we in Afghanistan? Because I still don't know. Why are men dying? Why are men fighting? Why are men getting maimed? For whom? For whom the bell tolls and why? Americans want us out of Afghanistan, incidentally. Now you say, oh, I'm shocked to hear that. We thought you were right wing. Don't you understand who I am yet? Don't you get who I am yet? Why are we in Afghanistan? I thought Obama was a peacenik. He comes to power and he increases the troop strength by 30,000. And to top it all off, in addition to increasing the war in Afghanistan, which we're not winning because of rules of disengagement, did you hear that they're actually giving medals for not fighting? Hold fire and earn a medal. You didn't hear this story. You're not going to believe it. You thought the rules of engagement under Bushki were bad. You're right. But U.S. troops in Afghanistan could soon be awarded a medal for not doing something. It would be given for courageous restraint, for holding fire to save civilian lives. I cannot believe what I'm looking at. It's as if they're saying American men are trigger happy and they go out of their way to kill civilians. You know that the enemy hides amongst their wives and children. You know that. So this is shocking that we have a military that's been turned into such putty by the liberals.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild.
We're talking now about cars and boats and planes and how much I love machines and how I went to the classic car show. I don't go to car shows, but I did, and I realized what I'm missing. And it takes a lot of work to keep these cars, you know, looking so beautiful, I guess. They truck them there, a lot of them. I was amazed that they sat in the hot sun and they let them sit without tenting them. I was quite surprised, you know, that kind of thing. So why do liberals hate classic cars is an interesting question. All I could think about as I walked around the fairgrounds looking at the beautiful cars was liberals and why they would love to ban this sort of gathering and how they'd like to turn these cars into a, you know, recycle them into sort of, I don't know, homeless shelters or something. I couldn't believe it's like two different universes, you know. Caterpillar C18 diesels, unbelievable engines. Unbelievable engines. And my boat just gets up and, you know, you got this 40-ton boat. You're doing 8 knots, 7 knots, 9 knots. You get her out through the Raccoon Straits and you're heading out toward the bridge if there are no pesky sailors or pesky the sailboats I can dodge, at least I could see them, but the schmucks on the kayaks I can't stand. They're as stupid as bicyclists on country roads. What do they have in their heads, these morons in kayaks? You're going out in a kayak in an open waterway, and there are boats, and we're supposed to see you in a turbulent bay, and you won't put a flag on the back of your schmuck kayak, your Nanook of the sea? How did you get your schmuck kayak to the water, I like to ask the putts. You put it on your stupid SUV and brought it there, idiot. But all of a sudden, you missed the purity. Now, I don't mind if a guy kayaks, but keep it to the side of the damn bay or put a flag on the back of your thing so no one runs you over. So I go out and I see the bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, and I want to head out to the sea. So I open the engines up. That boat jumps 40 tons. If I slam the throttles forward, I don't slam them. I push them forward. I don't like stressing an engine any more than I stress myself. I grade up fast, though, and I go to, let's say, I don't know, 2,200 RPM, and you'll see this boat move from 8 knots to 20 knots, 22 knots, like a fast speedboat. Think of it, 40 tons, and it'll move like that. Yes, the fuel consumption's enormous. A Cat C18, which runs about 1,000 horsepower each, you got 2,000 horsepower. When you're running at 2,300 RPM, you're burning about 52 gallons an hour on each engine. So let's say 100 gallons an hour on the boat. So that's your business? Who's paying for it, schmuck? You? I'm paying for it. You know how much of that is tax? A lot of it. If I want to burn 100 gallons an hour, that's my business. It's not your business. It's my business. That's how I see it.
Giddy up, giddy up. Giddy up, giddy up. When I take it to the track, she really shines. Giddy up, giddy up.
MichaelSavage.com. Any topic is a fair game, I suppose.
Giddy up, 409. My four-speed dual quad positive traction 409.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Welcome to the Hotel California. Such a lovely place, such a lovely place, such a lovely face.
Welcome to the Hotel California on the Savage Nation, the late great Golden State. How this state alone, you know, when I moved out here, I moved out here in 1974. It was a paradise. Everything was, I don't know, like a Technicolor Disney movie. It wasn't anything that was wrong about Northern California. I just loved it. And I moved here primarily because the schools were free. The public schools were great. And I never forget when my first child went off to the first grade in a little yellow school bus provided by the state. It was beautiful. I felt good in my heart. I was a poor, you know, graduate student trying to make a living. But I managed to scrape together every penny I saved in my life. I bought a little house. I had worked three jobs. Went to school. I just felt good about the future. I knew that both of my children, and I distinctly remembered, I said to myself, I'm not a rich man. I'm never going to be a rich man. Likely never a rich man. But that was okay. I never set out to be a rich man. We'll be able to go as far in school as they wish, based upon their own abilities and desires, because California had the fantastic educational system from education starting from the grade school. Then you had the Cal State system, which was one rung below the university system. And then I said there were graduate schools that were great here, medical schools, dental schools, law schools, engineering schools, whatever they wanted to do would be up to them. I never felt I was going to lead them, push them every step of the way. It's not the way I live. I wasn't raised that way. My father had a sink or swim philosophy. And although I was not quite as old-worldish about it as he was. I really, in some ways, you know, said that's it's up to them how far they want to go. The state was beautiful. The roads were paved. The streets were clean. And then slowly but surely, the liberal cancer started to infect the state. Governor Jerry Brown with his crazy ideas. And one after the other, they kept shoveling money at dead social programs. They started taxing business out of the state. They started to raise state income taxes, driving many productive citizens out of the state. They wouldn't crack down on the illegal aliens, even though people knew that they were bankrupting the schools and bankrupting the hospitals. And look where we are today. When you don't stop a cancer, the cancer spreads. It doesn't go away. Take a look where we've come today, where you have the administrators of the state and of the nation who cater to the cancer rather than to the healthy patient. What if you went to an oncologist and you said, "Doctor, I've been told that I have a cancer, but it can still be stopped. What are you going to do to stop the cancer?" And a doctor studies your illness and he says, "I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to feed the cancer. I'm not going to try to save the healthy cells. I'm going to feed the cancer and see if I can make the cancer worse." You'd say, well, the doctor is either insane or a criminal. In either case, he should have his medical license pulled. Your politicians are like oncologists who are treating not the cancer, but they're trying to make the cancer get bigger. Instead of saying the healthy cells know what they're doing and we're going to help them, we're going to stop the invasion of the cancer, they're taking the side of the cancer. It's the same in Arizona. It's the same in California. It's the same in Illinois. It's the same in New York. It's the same in Florida. But the politicians are all feeding the cancer, for example. You got it? What was I getting at before I got angry? I forgot. Oh, what I had for dinner. And I didn't want dinner. I had the greasy Chinese food for lunch. I figured that the spices would help me. I like a weird thing, but she cut back already on the seafood in the dish. I saw already she gave me too big a smile on the way out. I knew why. I mean, it's $16 to begin with, the seafood goo. And there was like a half the number of shrimp and half the number of whatever other garbage she puts in there. But I'm attenuated to the restaurant for 20 years. You know, sometimes it's like comfort food, even to eat bad in the restaurant. You never got food poisoning there, you go back. You like the melanine ware, tea in a melanine cup. You know, there's nothing like tea in a melanine cup in the afternoon, so to speak. But she cut back already on the seafood. She's trying to, you know, give people a good screwing. I'm not going to go in there again. I'm sorry. You got to cut it out. Listen, Betty, everyone knows what you're doing. That's it. I'm poisoned after this. I didn't get what I paid $15 for. Four little bay shrimp, the size of the tip of a pinky. That's not a shrimp. A shrimp is a prawn. Anyway, so I didn't get a big enough lunch, but that was okay. I didn't need it. Comes dinner, I'm not hungry. So I walk up to North Beach, the Italian district, and I visit my friend Lorenzo, who owns a North Beach restaurant. He's a friend of mine, and he and I really have a friendship more than it's a restaurant friendship that's evolved into an actual friendship. It's not like he's in my house a lot. I was at his ranch once in Sonoma when he cut the woods down and put in his orchard, his grape, or his olives. I remember all of that 16, 17 years ago. Whenever, I don't know how long ago it was, 15 years ago, I drove up in the old Caddy. I mean, this guy's from the old world. He and I have a nice comment. So we sit and talk, and he's all right, give him a vodka on me. I said, I don't want a vodka. I'm drinking Glenfiddich tonight. You, Savage, you're drinking Scotch whiskey? I said, yeah, I don't feel good. Just give me a Glenfiddich. 12-year-old, sipping the Glenfiddich. Water, no ice. No ice. No ice, man. You're going to get the Glenfiddich neat. No ice, just cold water. And I'm sipping, and we start to talk. So I said, well, I mean, he's, aren't you having dinner? I said, no, I'm not hungry. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, I'm going to make a soup for you. I'm going to go in the kitchen and make you a garlic soup. Not on the menu. Now, how could a guy not want the owner of a big restaurant to sit down with him and have a bowl of garlic soup? So I said, now remember, no dairy, no cream, no butter. And I pull his leg with that every time. No, I don't put in a butter, no creamer. No dairy, no butter, no creamer. He gets incensed every time I say that. He knows I hate dairy, that I'm allergic. He brings out a bowl. I swear to God, if you had an abscess and you had to put a finger in it to open up like a blister, you could have put your thumb in it and open up an abscess. It was so hot. So I dared reach into my water glass for a cube. He almost went crazy. No, you're going to dilute the soup. I said, yeah, I'm going to dilute it so I can eat it. I have to argue with him. It's like a relative with this guy. He loves me so much. He watches what I eat. He stays over me like a father. He almost picks up the spoon and feeds me, this guy. I said, will you leave me alone? Put the salt down. Stop it. He takes bread. He wants to put it in my soup for me. Stop it. Leave. Anyway, I'm kidding. See, he makes me the garlic soup. And that's what I had for dinner, garlic, a bowl of garlic soup. And a little Swiss chard with garlic. And that's, there's no big thing to the story. But what I'm saying is, it was wonderful. Did it cure the cold? No. You'd expect the punchline is, and I went home and I was cured. I was a miracle. No, I'm the same in the morning.
Savage.
How many people can raise their hands in this audience? You know, now this is like a live show. If I had 10,000 people, and I said this with a booming microphone, how many of you remember me saying to you, 2 years into Bush's administration, look out, he's bankrupting the country? I'd get 98% of the people would raise their hands. And how many of you remember that a year before Bush was finished, I said, look what he's doing. Look at the bills he's passed. No Child Left Behind, prescription drugs for the elderly. I said, this is no different than Hillary care, about 50% of Hillary care, right? You'd raise your hands again. Then, in September of the last year of his reign, September of 08, I believe, pretty sure that, yeah, I saw some strange and dangerous things going on. And I said, he's not through yet. He's finale in the last 3 months of his administration. And lo and behold, he engineered the economic meltdown, the financial collapse with Wall Street, in order to usher in who? Barack Hussein Obama. They wanted Obama to win. The Republicans wanted Obama to win. I've said that to you. Why do I say it to you over and over again? Well, I'm not going to give too much of it away, but because it's all in my new book, which is at the publisher right now. It's coming out in October. It'll be the biggest book of the time, I can guarantee you. It's going to be a very important book. And I'm not here to sell you a book, but I'm here to tell you that the reason the Republicans wanted to lose, and the reason they selected a loser like McCain who would guarantee lose, and even he almost won until he shot himself in the toe every time he opened his mouth. He could have won because Obama was so unappealing as a candidate to most of America. Obama was so frightening to most Americans once they understood his odd background, his left-wing leanings, his associations with known terrorists, the Reverend Wright. Any one of those stories would have brought Obama down if only McCain had wanted to exploit it. But McCain's handlers didn't want him to exploit it. They told him to play it down, not up. Why? Because the Republicans had raped the Treasury for 8 straight years, and they knew that they didn't want the hot seat in the next the next election. They knew a Democrat had to win. Now, whether it was Obama or Hillary, I'm not so sure whether they cared. But they knew it was time to throw the ball to the other gang of crooks. They wouldn't have cared if it was Hillary. They probably would have preferred it because she would have been a more reliable partner in the scheme, right? But, okay, whatever. Now, all you hear is, oh, bring back the Republicans, and I guarantee you we'll get rid of those tax and spend liberals when we come back. Hey, we're going to lower the government. We're going to take the bloat out of the government. We're going to lower your taxes. Step right up. This way to the egress. Get a Republican. Here's a Republican. Good old Republican. Come on, Republican. Come on, put down the flag. Put down the conservative flag. Come on, here's a Republican. Here's a Republican. There's a Republican. Then to top it all off, McCain has one thing going for him. Experience. Right? So how does he destroy his one calling card? He picks an inexperienced, unknown governor of Alaska who makes one gaffe after another, Sarah Palin. And everyone gasps, what? He couldn't have picked an admiral, a retired admiral? He couldn't have picked a retired general from who distinguished himself in Iraq? That would have put him over the top, but they didn't. Why did the puppet masters push Romney out of the way and have McCain win? Why did they push Romney away and push McCain in? Because they were afraid Romney might win by sheer accident. Good looking, he has a business background, more appealing, all-American family. Yes, quite liberal. He pushed forward a health care plan almost identical to that which Obama has. We all know this. But he would have won handily without almost a fight. And then strangely, don't you remember what happened at some some tumultuous backroom dealings somewhere along the campaign trail. Romney was pushed out and McCain was pushed in, and everyone said, what? McCain? Impossible. Again, New World Order, the way it's played. You know, you want the Democrats in for 8 years, then the 4 years of, I can guarantee you as I stand here that your expectations are false if you think Obama's going away after 4 years. That is not the way the establishment has the game rigged. It's like going to Las Vegas and thinking you can beat them at cards or you can beat them on a slot machine. That machine is wired to produce a certain number of wins per roll, per certain number of rolls. And the way this political machine is rigged is you got 8 years Repub, 8 years Dem. I don't care who that Dem is. I don't care how bad he is. He's going to win again. And the reason he's going to win again is because the Republicans are going to make sure he does. You don't know this. I don't care what happens in October. I don't care how many Tea Parties there are and how many people get knocked out of the box. I can guarantee you they're going to do something to have this guy win again, as sure as I'm standing here. At least I would bet on that. I bet 90% he wins again. And that's because I've seen not one Republican candidate come forward who's electable. There is not one Republican candidate who could be president. Sarah Palin can't win. She dismissed herself simply by taking a job with Fox News and becoming a commentator and an all-around money earner. No one's electing her. That's it. They run her. It's over. It's Obama in 2012. I'll bet on that one. If I were, what's his name? Nick the Greek. Remember, he used to be around, whatever his name was. And I'm not disparaging Greeks. There was a big odds guy. No one remembers some of these references. They're very obscure. Was it Nicky the Greek? Nick the Greek? I don't know. Jimmy the Greek. Don't say Jimmy because we'll get the guy from WR with communism. Please. I had a dog named Nicky. My favorite dog was named Nicky. Wonderful little dog. A Yorkshire Terrier killed by a frog. Heartbreaking. Went away once for a week. Left him with me. Came back dead. Buried in the ground. Bit a little frog. Poisonous. Like me with the spider. I don't know. So where was I? So I'm going from the political to the personal, which is, look, this is a long-haul business I'm in. I'm like a long-haul ice trucker, man. I'm in this one for the next whatever God gives me. Forever is not the on the books, okay? I know it awaits. I'm not missing one meal. With the skin, no, without the skin, I'm not missing a meal. Oh, I'm Yisrael High. I'm Yisrael High. Hey, do you have the Hatikvah in honor of Rahm Emanuel's trip to Israel? Play the Israeli national anthem in honor of Rahm Emanuel's visit to the Western Wall, to a sensitive archaeological site that's closed to the public for having a bar mitzvah for his son. So they say, ultra... It's not the national anthem. It's close, all right. It's klezmer music. Klezmer music disgusts me, by the way. It's the music of the beaten Jew in Poland. I never liked klezmer music. That's like American views of Jews. They should play stupid music like that. It's like Woody Allen, they think, is a Jew. You know what I'm saying? Don't get me started on this topic. You know, it's like triggering something in me that gets me mad. I don't want to go down this road. Do you actually have the Hatik for the actual music? All right. No, of course not, because you're not oriented in that direction. But if I asked you for the original music of the Horst Wessel, you could find that in a second, couldn't you?
Joe and Paul, a store of far kriegen, brabrilla Joe and Paul, that wet your bully kriegen, brabrilla suit, a coat, a geeten zole, perfect, a fit and daft here, kuifen, nor by Joe and Paul.
Oh, God in heaven. It's like the last days of Pompeii on the Savage Nation. Oh my God, what if I said to you, like, I'm leaving radio in a week and I'm just going to do everything I ever wanted to do? Well, guess what, that's what I've been doing for 16 years. I run every show as though it's my last. I never thought I'd last three shows. When I first started radio, they said, you'll never last because your accent is too New York. That was a code word. I said, okay, you'll never last because you're too conservative in a liberal city, okay? You'll never last because you're too blunt, okay? You'll never last because you hang up on callers, etc. Well, guess who's laughing now? I outlasted them all, and I've only just begun.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
You know, that's the biggest racket in America is those, all the restaurants are suffering, so they're all doing the happy hours now, and some of them are really piling on the food. That's the road to perdition. They're finished. Once they start with the very luxurious buffets to get you in for the cheap wine, they don't last long. It's impossible. San Francisco, there was a bar like that. They really put out a spread. Every grifter with a suit and tie was in there. Oh, would they gobble? You know the tricks on that one, don't you? They go to the first they go in the back door to hit the free buffet first. Normally, if you're you get a drink, then you go to the buffet and you get the shrimp and the this and the cheesy. They had half unemployed men from the financial district of San Francisco. They go in the back door of this boy. He's out of business now, and they would get 2-3 plates full because they remember their days as a busboy and when they were young. They could bring 3 little trays of plates over to the table. Then they'd sit themselves down at one of those round, like, stand-up bar tables. The poor girl who comes over is trying to make a buck with a drink, and you give her a tip of a dollar. Now, listen to what some of these crumbs would say. Can I get you a drink, sir? He's knocking down the chips and the cheese and, God, the celery and the carrots. There's a whole meal there. It's like a V8 vegetable salad. He has the nerve to say, no, I'm waiting for somebody, you hear? I would throw the bum right out. I'd take the dishes out of his hand and throw them out of the bar. I said, that's not our policy. You eat, you drink. What are they so nice to these deadbeats for? Everybody is so nice to everyone except a conservative. The least nice, the only person they're allowed to be nasty to is someone who actually believes in God and family and loves America. Everyone else they get on their hands and knees for. An Iranian terrorist, fine, welcome to my bar. I say, you come over and you say, that's not our policy, sir. You're going to have to order a drink or put the food down and get the hell out of here. Why is that not right to say to a deadbeat in a place like that with a buffet? Or on the other hand, I'm going to ask you something else since I'm in a cheerful mood. And if I don't celebrate feeling good when I feel good, I know what God has waiting for me. So I actually am entertaining I'm entertaining God right now. He wants me to be like a minstrel. So I'm dancing around with the microphone to show him I'm happy. That's my way of praying. It was a touch and go. You don't try to talk and nothing comes out. You know how that, you know what that's like? It's like a pilot getting up one day and he's like, he has like neurosis, like blindness, hysterical blindness, the pilot. He can't fly. So what would he do? He's finished. What if you're a surgeon and you wake up and you can't see or it's blurry? Bingo, you're out of business. The next thing is you're voting communist straight down the line and you want the rich to pay for your vacations in Boca Raton so you could steal shrimp. That's the way it works. You always want someone else to give you money for you to go gambling at the Mohawk Casino so that Chris Dodd can give him $52 million of stimulus money so that they can bust more of these seniors in from Boca Raton all the way up to Connecticut to give away the money they say they don't have. What would be wrong? Let me ask you something, a question. What would be wrong if at a buffet, let's say, an all-you-can-eat buffet in Boca, I'm using Boca as an example. It could be Astoria, Queens. It could be Mill Valley, California. There's an Indian buffet off the highway. Hard to rob from a Sikh. Don't even try it. They all have knives on. No, you don't want to. You Chinese, you can get away with it still. They're most of them, you know, they're without papers, and they're still afraid of you. But don't try it with a Sikh, man. Those guys, they're all big. It's that ghee, I think, that they eat. I don't know, like 6-foot, big, healthy, strong warrior class. Very nice people. I really never met a Sikh I didn't seek out. I mean, they're very nice people, truthfully. I get along with them very well. Always a nice conversation. Tell me about the disputed lands. You see the eyes again. What? Kashmir. Oh, Kashmir, ancient land. You know, the yogurt. My grandfather laid in yogurt fields. I'm joking. There's no such thing as a yogurt field. You know what I'm saying. It's a generic. What would be wrong if in an all-you-eat, they had a cousin, let's say a schmecky cousin, who gave up terrorism and they hired him in one of these places? He originally came to work for Al-Qaeda, and he realized what a putz he was. But once he was here, he didn't want to go back to Pakistan. So they hire him, let's say. And his job was part-time dishwasher and to survey who's robbing the buffet, let's say. And if he sees a bulky coat in the summertime, would it be wrong of him to say, ma'am, please come with me, in broken English, and take her into a back room where they take off the coat and look for the stolen, you're giving it an Indian buffet. What can you steal? You can't even steal anything from there. See, that's the difference. There are no sweet and lows in the Indian buffets, incidentally. You think they're stupid? And there's no salt and peppers that you can take. It's already in the food. They don't put packages out. It's very clever the way it works. So the question is, couldn't you demand it back? Why not embarrass somebody who robs you from a buffet? See, I'm not made for the restaurant business. People have said to me, you know, you got a popular show. It's the third biggest show in the country. You could open a restaurant. You could put your name on it. They come from thousands of miles away. It's all true, but I'd be the worst restaurant owner. My eye would always be on how much they're taking from me. I'm not naturally given. See, I know guys in the business, they're generous in terms of food. They get pleasure out of seeing you eat. I don't get pleasure out of seeing the other guy eat. It's not my business that he should have pleasure eating. Why do I care if he's getting pleasure or not getting pleasure from eating? So I don't get you have to have a nature. You know who fails in the restaurant business? Guys who don't get genuine pleasure out of watching the other man eat. And the guys who succeed have a love for food, number one, and they actually are somewhat maternal in a way of wanting you to eat and feel good. I don't have that in me, which is why I never went into the business. You have to have that in you in order to be good in there. And every restaurant that succeeds, there has to be a guy who owns it there that you talk to, like you're going to, hey, a patron, right? I don't like generic restaurants with like guys with pimples or whatever, or, you know, I don't like it. Or at girls who at night, God knows where their fingers are. I don't even want to go into it in San Francisco with the purple fingernails. I don't want it to touch my hand or the food. They look like normal kids next door, but they're not. They're sick in the head, most of them here. You don't want them to do in the food, like the food world. But most of the people in the food world are a little demented. That's how they wound up in there to begin with. It gives them a lot of time at night to get into trouble with the dungeons. San Francisco, I don't know what's like a whole industry of secret dungeons. I never saw anything like it. At night, the dungeons. In the morning, they're vegetarians. You offer them a I don't drink caffeine. At night, you can't believe what they must be doing. At night, the dungeons, the screaming, you can only imagine. But in the morning, they're as pure as the driven snow. Oh, no, I'm a lactobovo vegetarian. I don't eat meat. No, I don't touch that stuff. I need purity in my body. Unbelievable. So as I say to you, what would be wrong with, in essence, frisking an old woman who robbed from a buffet and throwing her out on her raincoat? Why? Why can't they do it? That's what I'm saying. I'm sorry, madam. You're a grifter and a crook. Get out of my restaurant and leave the sweet and low. Why would that be wrong to do if you have a cousin, let's say, from Pakistan who gave up terrorism, who could work for you at the door? New York, W.R. John, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I'm a full-time paid firefighter in New Jersey. On September 11th, I watched the towers burn and fall. I watched 343 of my brothers perish. I wanted to go and help. I didn't want to get paid. I grabbed my gear. We went in. They turned us back. Why did they turn us back? Because they were getting federal funds. They were going to be getting federal funds. And they didn't want...
Bingo.
Any of the money.
Bingo. Bingo. Triple bingo. You won the lotto. That's what Obama's minions are doing. You're using the Coast Guard as muscle to stop the Louisiana people from defending their own wild lands. And they're doing it because they want that money from BP to clean it up and running it through the sieve of the union bosses.
Exactly what they're doing.
It's so naked and blatant that any man, blue collar, white collar, yellow collar, pink collar, no collar, can see this. How? What am I, the only one who said this, John? Am I the only one who said that he did it on purpose, that he stopped the barges on purpose so they can get the money off the top?
You're not the only one. We've watched it happen several times, and we're sick of it. We're sick of it. It made us ill. September 11th made us ill for years. Every time I see a picture of the Twin Towers, I get sick.
No, go tell that to Mayor Bloomberg, who's building a mosque on the site. He don't care.
He makes me ill.
No, he's another one. He is nakedly Machiavellian as they come, that guy. But let's let that go. Thanks for the call. Sad story. New York, Tom, welcome to the Savage Nation. Get the Sleepy Mary song ready for Tom.
C'è una luna mezzumata, mamma mia, mamma di dare. Figlia mia, cosa dare, mamma mia, pensaccia tu.
Go ahead, please.
Mike, listen, I'm sitting in traffic in the Throgneck Bridge, and I love that Italian music. The only one issue, it's whetting my appetite, and I can't go anywhere right now.
So let's say, because you're right near City Island, I bet you if you wish, you could come off the bridge and go have some what? What would you have?
I'd go right to Bell Boulevard. I'm going to move for Fettuccine Alfredo, something nice and heavy.
So you mean the music alone makes you salivate?
Oh, that music reminds me of sitting in Brooklyn at my grandpa's at his table with his my brother-in-law's and uncles. It brings back great memories.
I understand. So let me ask you, let's say you're a few generations removed from that. Where would you get your Italian food since the family situation is no longer the same?
Well, in Brooklyn, we'd go and get our fresh mozzarella at the Eagle Shop. Now, I don't know if it's there anymore. I live in the islands. And the prime meat I'll get from my grandfather's butcher shop, that's on Mermaid Avenue, Major Meat.
All right, well, your grandfather is still in the butcher business?
No, he's since deceased, and the business was open since 1927. They closed it, but they're revitalizing, quote-unquote, Coney Island. And after 80 years of my grandfather's butcher shop, there's a Mexican butcher shop in there now. In other words...
So, but you can't get the cuts of meat that you want, can you?
No, you can get a hell of a burrito, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, it's a different cuisine. It has its own pluses and minuses. I like a burrito once in a while. My body can't digest beans. That's the problem. It's not even a joke. I don't have the enzymes to digest beans. Would you believe that? It's not part of my cuisine. I cannot eat beans.
Yeah.
And if you think I'm going to eat a dinner with Beano, you're mistaken. I'm not taking an enzyme to go with a dinner. In other words, my body's saying don't eat it. You know, if your body don't have the enzyme for it, don't eat it. I just don't do well with beans. I don't even eat fava beans. You shouldn't eat them, by the way. You know, you talk about food. I know a lot about the ins and outs of the chemistry of foods. People don't realize this. Back in 1982, I published a book called The Skeptical Nutritionist. I'll never forget it to this day. And in my Macmillan published it. In my research, I discovered that fava beans, you know fava beans? They're a very big part of the Italian diet, particularly in traditional Italian diets. And they've come back now. Play that sound one more time.
C'è una luna mezzumara, mamma mia, mamma di dare. Figlia mia, cosa dare, mamma mia, pensacci tu.
I'm Michael Savage. We'll be right back.
Se te piglia lo pesciaiole, isso vai, isso vena, se vuole lo pescia, manatena.
Savage.
We all enjoyed Godfather 1. We all enjoyed Godfather 2. Now, we all went to the movies. I'll never forget the day. I can tell you where and when I was when GF3 opened. I went to a theater in Marin, a 70-millimeter movie when I still went to movies. Here was the sequel, Godfather 3. And it's the infamous scene with Andy Garcia, who was, if you remember at the time, an actor. Today, he's working as a busboy in the Concord Hotel in Monticello, New York. He's running the largest station in the Concord Hotel, which is now a homeless shelter. At that time, Andy Garcia was an up-and-coming actor, good-looking young guy. And the famous love scene was between him and the leading lady in GF3. Out comes Coppola's daughter. There was a noticeable gasp in the auditorium. There must have been 2,000 people. They went, oh. They were shocked. She looked like Helen Thomas as a young woman. And nobody could believe that a director would use a young Helen Thomas as a lead, even if it was his daughter. A man who made such great movies wouldn't do that to himself. But his career never survived that, by the way. Nepotism can ruin a person's career. Do you remember that? I'm just thinking out loud. We're just kibitzing here like it's the Cafe Savage, like I used to do in the early days. You can only do politics for so long. Do you remember when I used to do Cafe Savage? And raise your hands if you remember when I used to do afternoon radio and we'd have the sound of cafes clinking glasses and cups. And I said, make believe. No, that's too Frenchy for me. Turn it off. That's a little too Marais Chevalier, which is a little on the child molestation. You know, every little reason, little girl. The guy was a molester. There's no question in my mind there was a sicko there with the spats and the gloves and the cane. This guy was a sick one. That's why the French love him so much, him and Woody Allen. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind why Woody Allen's popular in France. It's where it belongs. I wish he'd move there and open a restaurant called Katz's. Woody Allen's Katz's restaurant, where we serve the worst food on earth. We enslave you with our corned beef. But I used to have Cafe Savage, where it was the sound of clinking cups and glasses. I remember we had the sound effect. And I would say to people, come on into the cafe and make believe it's my cafe. I'm behind the bar. And I'm serving you, you know, espresso, cappuccino, macchiato. In San Francisco, they have 5,000 names for coffee, and they're all bad. Go try to get a regular coffee, and they never heard of it. They look like you're crazy. I went to Starbucks the other day. They do it to me every time when they get a new crew of kids who just graduated college in finance and can't get a job. So they take a job as a barrister. I don't laugh at the kids. Look, they have to start somewhere. So I go in every time. It's the same thing. I say, I'll have a small coffee. The guy says, you want a tall coffee? I said, small. He said, we call a tall small. I said small. I don't care how your brain is twisted. Why would you call a small tall? What do you think? I'm stupid? I mean, why would you call a small coffee a tall coffee and a big coffee? What do you call a big coffee? A giant, you schmuck? I almost get into an argument with them every time. I said, a small coffee. Then I get guilty for arguing with a kid who's making minimum wage, and I always leave a dollar tip, which I do. I'm an overtipper. Some are overachievers. I'm an overtipper. I don't mean to argue with everybody, but stupidity gets to me no matter where I turn. If I order a small coffee, I don't want the schmuck with pimples to say, oh, you want a tall coffee. And they do it, by the way, to just ride you. They know what you mean. If the kid was taught anything by Starbucks, when a customer comes in and give me a small coffee, say, okay, you don't have to lecture him that it's called a tall in our establishment because you're alienating the customer. He might come back, you know, and you might have a job another day if you actually said, okay. They always, something about San Francisco is everyone here, no matter how lowly they are, they have to correct you. No matter who you are, whatever you say to them, they correct your words. Whatever, wherever, whatever call it is. You call a plumber, you say A, they say B. They try to correct your pronunciation or your enunciation or your spelling. I never saw anything like this. And most of them are illiterate morons and never went to school. That's why I say, when I say small, I mean small. I don't mean tall. And on that note, play the tarantella for me because I need to relax. Because even the show is replayed in so many places on different days, hours. I got to be careful what I say now. What I say now at night is replayed the next day in San Francisco in the morning. People are waking up listening to this and listening to it while it's live and the next day and it's replayed and parlayed. Now, play a couple other pieces from The Godfather. It's very appropriate. You know, when remember that great scene in The Godfather? I'm going to go back to GF1, where Don Corleone is in the garden. Beautiful, touching scene with Michael Corleone, played by Al Pacino, in his last scene before he dies of a heart attack with the grandchild. It's actually a very touching scene. I watched it the other day, and I realized why it touched me so deeply. My father had died just before this movie. I remember when they were making it, and they saying it was coming out, and I said, gee, my dad would love this movie. Then he died, and he couldn't see it because it was like from his era, you know. So I watched the movie. It was very personal to me, that movie. But I remember the Godfather figure with Marlon Brando sitting in the garden talking to Michael. What? No, you don't have to play it. And he says to him, what's wrong, Michael? Michael says to him, what's wrong, Dad? And then Marlon Brando says with an incredible, what an actor this guy was. He says, I don't know, Michael. He says, I dreamed that one day you'd be Senator Corleone, Congressman Corleone, Governor Corleone. We didn't have enough time, Michael. We didn't have enough time. And then Michael says, it's okay, Dad. We'll get there. You know, he said, okay, they're gangsters. But there was a human element in that interchange that's astounding. And I think about that with regard to the situation we're living in today. And I wonder to myself, did they finally get enough time? But it could be that I watch too much movies, too many movies. It's possible. I mean, I do watch too many movies, I admit it. I'm starting to realize that too many of the things that I look at in the world are seen through the lens of fiction. The Savage Nation, broadcasting from San Francisco to the world. One man's opinion, that's all. Just my opinion. I try to back it up with facts. You don't want to read the facts, I can't help you.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
People fear Obama. You've got to understand they fear him because he is a radical left winger. Now you say, okay, fine, we know that. Do you know he's actually he was the most radical left wing senator in American history? Now that he has absolute power, do you think he's suddenly become a centrist? You say, well, thus far he hasn't really done anything that's too dramatically to the left. You're wrong. Take a look at the czars he has placed around himself, and you'll know what's coming in this country. I got to scare you for a little bit because I'm a student of the worst example of totalitarianism that the last century has to offer in the West, and I have chosen Nazi Germany. I could have chosen Stalin in Russia. I could have gone back and studied the Bolshevik rise to power in Russia, which we could do. But a very interesting comparison could be made to the National Socialists of Germany. And the reason I mention National Socialists is because it's not well understood that Hitler was actually a socialist as well as a nationalist. He tried to create a hybrid between the nationalists who were in the SA, the brown shirts, who were diehard anti-socialists, and they were all nationalists, Ernst Röhm. But there was a whole other part of Germany that was quite capitalist, and those were the industrialists who backed Hitler in the beginning. And he had to placate them in the beginning, the same way this administration is currently placating the bankers and the other large industrialists, if you want to still call them that. So he plays the game of placating the military, send them more troops. He's placating the industrialists who are tolerating him right now, who came out for him. And then he's, you know, I can name several of them. I don't think I have to fill in the blanks. He's placating, to a certain extent, the socialist base of his party, but not to the extent that you would expect because it's early on in the administration. It's only been 9 months. So you have a mixture of the nationalists, which we see nothing of here because Obama is not a national socialist. The one thing he is not a national socialist. He is a socialist through and through. But you say, well, if you say he's a socialist, how can you say he's a socialist when so many capitalists supported him and still do support him? Well, that's because you don't understand that he's on a stepping stone to outright communism by using the industrialists to get him there. He's not really at the pace that he would like to be. He's still in the childhood of his administration. Remember that. He's only just started. There's an infancy, a childhood, an adolescence, and an adulthood. Obama is right now past the infancy of his presidency, taking his first childhood steps. And some people are starting to open their eyes to the threat that Obama poses to the world. That is outside of America, not inside America. Yes, outside of talk radio, where the thought police do not dominate, people are understanding the dangers we may be in. But the fact of the matter is he wants to run and rule society according to the laws of the socialists that have run and ruined societies in the past. The only question we really have about Obama and his minions are these. How dangerous is he? How far would he really go? What would he really do to those who oppose him should he have absolute power? We don't know how far he would go. We just don't know the depths of the tyranny within the man's soul. We've never tested him. Now, you had fascists in Italy under Benito Mussolini. You had the Nazis in Germany under Adolf Hitler. And the fact is that both of them went through a transitory symbiotic relationship with the corporate strata of each of the two nations in which they first appeared. Let me repeat that. Both the fascist Mussolini and the National Socialist Hitler went through a transitory symbiotic relationship with the corporate business strata in each of their nations in the beginning. Transitory now, okay? In the beginning, they had to do business with the capitalists. You understand that? It was Mussolini who embraced the system of capitalism the most wholeheartedly. He was not really he was not truly anti-capitalist. Hitler, on the other hand, only flirted with capitalism for a few years until his own internal divisions within his own Nazi party, primarily from the nationalist wing of National Socialism, objected to his dancing with who they thought were the devil, which were the capitalists. You understand that? Mussolini was only a populist megalomaniac. He was not truly a racist and a messianic racist. Hitler was a messianic racist. Do you understand that? Mussolini, on the other hand, was a populist megalomaniac, not quite on the same level. He was into nationalism. He reverted to the nostalgia for the glories of the grandeurs of Imperial Rome. We all know that. But it took them time, both of them, to gain total power. And so, along the way, they had a temporary symbiotic alliance with the corporate structure. One to build a Third Reich in Germany, the other to rebuild Imperial Rome, both eventually under fascism themselves. Do you understand that? I'm trying to explain to you that there's a big difference between pure socialism, national socialism, and what we're seeing in America today. And if you think that you're not seeing any of the same elements that were seen in the last century, then you're an ignorant fool. New York City, WOR, Matt, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, yeah, you always talk about, and you just said that history's repeating itself, and, you know, Ahmadinejad may be Hitler reincarnate and whatnot. Who would you consider yourself?
I have no answer to that question. I don't think a man can judge himself in history. I have no idea if I even have a place in history. I'd say I'm a populist writer, a populist broadcaster. I've written 25 books. I've had 15 great years in radio. I don't know what that means historically.
History to know, you know, who I would compare you to. The only thing I know is that, you know, you're one of the only people speaking out for what you feel is right.
Well, I think there are others who speak out. I see it all the time. I read about it all the time. They do it in their own way on different subjects. There's certainly enough people who are trying to hold Obama up to the standards of American decency. I don't know if they're getting anywhere, what with the mainstream media being 98% in the pocket of the Obama administration.
Yeah. Well, what's scary is the czars here. This is some sort of shadow.
The czars are un-American. They should be taken out of business. They should immediately be removed from office. There is no question in my mind, no American president in history has ever appointed czars. Think of the word themselves, czar? The czar? Not appointed? No vetting? Nobody knows who they are? Every one of them, when you turn the rock over under which they came from, they turn out to have written on the glories of communism or socialism? What does that tell you about Obama's long-range goals?
Sounds like a shadow government he's setting up for when he takes power of this.
Well, oh my goodness, I pray to God every night. I pray to God that it's only paranoia. I swear to God, Matt, and everyone else listening to the show, I got to tell you, every night I have to say to myself, let's put aside all the rhetoric, let's put aside all of the theatrics, and let me analyze for myself just exactly where is Obama coming from and where does he want to take this country. Now, you could say on one hand, your worst fears have never materialized in your life. Why should you think that your worst fears about Obama will materialize? Well, I'll answer that question. Because often it is not the individual in power who you have to fear, it's the people around him who you have to fear. He himself may be just a mainstream, good-natured leftist who wants to do good for the most number of people. That's possible. But if you look at some of the absolutely dark-hearted individuals who he has put in as czars, the dark-hearted people behind him in Chicago, you should be frightened to the core of your being. That's what I come to. That is my absolute opinion. And the reason I think that we should fear this is because there is no counterstroke going on from the Republicans. Do you remember that when Bush was in power, virtually every day there was criticism by the mainstream media or by the Democrats? Every time Bush said something, did something, if he burped, there was a response by one of the Democrats. Right now, we don't have a two-party system. We've had a very tepid two-party system for a good 30 years now, but right now we simply have a one-party system, which I have named Republicrats or Democrats in 1994. We have a Republicrat system. It's two sides of the same coin. There are exceptional individuals who truly still carry the banner of American freedoms. I understand that. But they're so insignificant in number and in power that I say we have a one-party system. And whereas under George Bush, virtually every statement, every act, every law, every bill, every movement, every dinner, every piece of fish that he ate, there was a counter comment by one of the Democrats in the media or in the Congress. With Obama, there's virtually no response other than the man is great and is being picked on by the evil right-wing conspiracy. So given that this is the toxic stew in which we find ourselves, I think that you should be very worried indeed. But again, it's only one man's opinion. So forgive me if you disagree with me.
Savage.
I'm such an obsessive when it comes to food. You know that already. Everything has to be a meal and a special and a preparation. Because I'm getting fed up. I mean, I'll give you an example. I went to one restaurant. I go to it a lot. Not on Fisherman's Wharf. Not the place I love. I'll say it's in Marin County. Okay? Just so you know. I order a minestrone soup. The broth tasted simply like hot water. Okay? With like a cube in it. And none of the vegetables were cooked. What is this with not cooking a vegetable in minestrone soup? Who would have eaten this in the years gone by? Nobody. An Italian grandmother would have thrown it out off a fire escape. Let's say you were a kid and she said, all right, make a minestrone soup. And you didn't cook the vegetables. And it was just like hot water. She'd throw it out of the window. That they served that in a restaurant. You know, every minute, senor this and senor that and this and the oil and the bread. But the food you can puke from. So I stopped already. That's why I'm eating granola now and fresh fruit. Fresh fruit. It's horrible. I don't understand this. What would you like to talk about? Because I said it has to be your show. I'm enjoying the music so far. What music can I play right now? You have another Italian favorite? Not Dean Martin. It's enough. It's old-fashioned. They don't like that. Any Italian movie? Perry Como? He's too old. Bail me out here, Phil. I mean, do something with a little music. Try it, at least. I'm groping here.
Volare.
And Volare. Okay. Memories, memories, memory. I love Gantare. I love that part of the... How you speak Italian like that. What dialect is that? Neapolitan? Napolitano? Janet Napolitano? She's a Napolitano. She's a Napolitan. She's a Napolitana, excuse me. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to insult her. She's a Napolitana, not a Napolitan. Janet Napolitano's a Napolitana. There's nothing wrong with that. Gantari, isn't that Neapolitan? Neapolitano. The organ I could do without reminds me of ice skating. It's in... Ice skating music always depresses me. Look how things trigger things in your head. I don't like the organ. I know it's a very tough instrument to play. Phantom of the Opera and all of that. The most difficult of all the keyboards is an organ. But it reminds me of ice skating in Flushing Meadow Park at night with my uncle when I hated school. So it's always bad. It's like remembrances of things past. When I hear an organ, I get depressed. Funerals. I'm sorry. Funerals, too. Whenever you're an organ, it's a funeral. Why? It's just an associational thing. I'm trying to change the subject. I can't take it anymore. I got to tell you, let me go back. Can I take a deep breath? Go one, two, three. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. Oh, that feels good, man. That's good. I just took a toke of the O2. It feels good, I got to tell you. Every time I go to a restaurant, I ask them, can I have a dish for Teddy? And he brings me out water like, you know, Hetch Hetchy 09. And I say, that's my dog, champagne. Bring me a glass of that, too. You know, that costs nothing. I don't even drink bottled water anymore. It's just like Hetch Hetchy with ice. My favorite new drink. If it works for my dog, it must work for me. I'm not saying I'm ready to try the dog food, but I'm telling you the truth. There's a little crossover here. The dog food I give him is more or less what I eat anyway. I mean, I went to a restaurant, got him a hamburger. There's a double reason I give him a hamburger before I order. Why? Because what I order takes, like, in a certain restaurant I go to, it's like 20 minutes till they make the beef bourguignon or 20 minutes for this. Meanwhile, the dog's hamburger, no salt and pepper, comes out in 3 minutes and I eat half of it. It's like an appetizer. What could be better? It's like having a child. There are advantages to having a child. You get to eat candy, which you don't eat anymore. You get to act like an idiot running around. You're walking on all fours on the floor. That's the beauty of having children and grandchildren, is you can become a child again. And that's the beauty of having a dog, is you can start you can get away with things like ordering a hamburger before the meal for the dog and eat half of it. What does he know? He's only 10 pounds. Now, don't think I'm ripping off my dog's food by doing it. Let me explain something to you. If he weighs 10 pounds, just do math with me. If you can still do math in your head, I can do. I only do math, man. I taught myself never to use a computer for math, which is why no one can rob me of money. I don't need to go to a digital calculator. My brain was built way back in the HAL 9000 days in the Bronx, where I had to memorize mathematical tables. But I don't need a calculator to do simple math. So my dog weighs 10 pounds. And let's say, I don't want to give too much away, I weigh 170. For argument's sake, that's what I'm now. Around, no, 160. I don't know what I, no, 170. Okay, God, I can't lie. So the dog's 10, I'm 170. So I'm 17 times heavier than the dog, right? So here's the short answered question for the math test. If I give the dog a quarter pound burger, what is that equivalent in meat to a 170 pound man? That's ridiculous. Like eating a horse. So he doesn't eat a quarter pound burger. He'll eat like a python till he explodes. So I have to like calculate backwards and give him 1/11th of what I'm giving him. You don't give him a man-sized hamburger, and this restaurant doesn't give him a quarter pounder. This guy, he's an old friend of mine. He's a Bass guy, and he gives him a burger. Oh, you pay for it. What's the difference? But no, it's a nice piece of meat. This is no leftover. This is not from Walmart, from the meat that fell underneath when the holiday ended under the truck while the guy was off on a vacation, and it rolled over in the sun a few times and actually started to run away from the meat packet. It's not that kind of meat. We're talking about a grade A hamburger, you know? So let's say you take, what, he's giving me a half of him? No, it couldn't be a half. A third of a pound of meat. Now I'm going to get complicated. If a dog weighs 10 pounds and a man weighs 170 pounds and he gives him a third of a pound of a hamburger, and he gets a third of a pound of a hamburger on the table, what size hamburger should he give the dog to make certain that the dog doesn't drop dead of a heart attack?
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Began doing the requested abdominal work on him, he became somewhat vocal. With muffled moans, etc., he began demanding that I go lower and massaging on the abdominal area. I was shocked, and I did not massage beyond what is considered a safe non-sexual area of the abdomen. He further insisted
in cut out the drill.
Angry, becoming verbally sharp and loud. I went into much deeper shock as I realized it appeared he was demanding sexual favors or sexual behaviors. I decided to declare I got so freaked I just got, but I got a tiny bit mad under my terror. I decided to clarify things by asking him, as he angrily complained that I was not doing what he wanted, for him to show me exactly what he wanted me to do, such as where to massage. I said, well, why don't you show me? I thought, this is too nuts. He grabbed my right hand hard, shoved it down under the sheet to his pubic hair area, and said to me, there, in a very sharp, loud, angry-sounding tone.
Now that, she is talking about the man who would save the world from global warming. You know, there's a bit of psychology here. And aside from the salaciousness and the jokes and the comedic nature of it, one could do a reasonable thesis in psychology on a man so obsessed with the concept, the false concept of global warming when there is none, and his own heat, his own body heat, his own mental heat. In other words, this man is in heat all the time. He's horny, in other words, frustrated. And here's a man who's rich and powerful, right, revered by millions, and he can't get any sex. So he goes to some poor masseuse and tries to get, you know, release. And he picks the wrong one. He actually picks a straight one, the one out of 1,000 that's actually in it for the massage, as opposed to the... Listen to the next one in clip 5.
He was moaning, groaning, moving, and acting in a very suggestive way. It was unreal. I never even had any of my hotel clients get angry, yell, or act out at me before. During the massage episode, I realized, much to my horror, that I was in the perfect storm and that I was in a room with someone who was Teflon-coated in terms of his credibility and celebrity status.
All right. So, again, this is amazing how stupid these rich guys, you know, it's amazing to me when you compare this one to a Spitzer, who would be so stupid as to go to hookers and pay on credit cards, number one. And this was a man who supposedly had the power over Wall Street, to show you how brilliant Spitzer was. He was the governor of New York, had the power over Wall Street, and he's so smart that he used the credit card to buy hookers. That shows you the genius. He didn't even think of using cash, let's say. So he used the credit card and got caught, and he's such a genius that CNN hired him. He's perfect for CNN. Now, the only place left for Al Gore to go would be CNN after this one, because what's coming next is something that you would hear in Marin County, California, or Austin, Texas, or some of the other denizens of idiocy, when he goes into another tactic to try to get her to touch him in inappropriate areas in clip six.
He then tried another tactic as though he had very suddenly switched personalities and began in a pleading tone, pleading for release of his second chakra there. There's so much.
Wait, stop it. Now, for those of you who don't know what a second chakra is, we're not talking about S-H-O-C-K-R-A, not chakra. In other words, not chakra. In other words, not his second chakra, meaning you release him and he has a shock and he goes raw. No, not his second chakra, his second chakra, which is a different story. But you have to be an expert on Indian food to understand that. And you have to go into Oriental restaurants and bow and put your hands together to get a napkin and a glass of water in order to understand what a chakra is. So play that one again.
He then tried another tactic as though he had very suddenly switched personalities and began in a pleading tone, pleading for release of his second chakra there. There's so much tension being held. This was yet another euphemism for sexual activity he was requesting, put cleverly as though it were a spiritual request or something. I was further deeply shocked and repulsed as my realization of what was happening sunk in, and especially as my mind was now reeling from this absolute betrayal by someone I had inherently trusted as a good guy who cares about people, including me, because of his public persona.
So she was shocked by his chakra. Let's put it to you that way. The masseuse was shocked by Gore's chakra. That's all. That's the headline. Shocked by his chakra. Accuser calls him a crazed sex poodle. I have to hide this from my poor dog. If he hears any of this, it could pervert him. This is really good stuff. This is great. Actually, we missed the first one because there are men like this that I've seen all my life. They've always given me the creeps, and I'm a man, by the way. The kind of guy that if you're a woman, have you been in social settings with the kind of guy who will hug you and hold you a little too tight and pull you towards him and you know what I'm saying? Like, I know women over the years, there are kind of creepy guys who are always like goofballs who don't really have, you know, luck with women, who when they hug a woman, they either hug them too tightly or they pull them against them too tightly and don't let them go in order to feel their bosoms against their chest, to be very polite about it. Listen to clip two.
I knocked on the door. Al Gore opened the door, and I introduced myself, saying, "Hello, I'm your massage therapist. How shall I call you?" He answered, "Call me Al," with a big smile, as he stretched out his arms to wrap me into an embrace as a greeting in the inner entryway of the room as I stepped inside. He was wearing a long-sleeved dress shirt. It was a medium bright blue, I think, open at the collar, and dark pants, which were slacks, I think. The hug went on a bit long, and I was taken just a bit aback by it. If it weren't Al Gore, I would have seriously been questioning the situation right there, because a hug from an unknown male client before the session is a bit odd and unprofessional by typical LMT business standards.
Did LMT? What's LMT? Does anyone know what LMT means? Ah, licensed massage, only in America, LMT. All right. Finally, we have the story of the exact muscle groups that he wanted worked on, the glutes, the hamstrings, the quads, and the adductors. Listen to clip three.
He described a grueling travel schedule over the previous week or two, mostly by air, and he said he needed his gluteus, hamstring, quadriceps, and adductors worked on, as well as his abdominal area besides his back and whole body. I inquired if this was due to the long flight hours, and he said yes. I mentally noted that a request for adductor work is a bit unusual. In the massage world, sometimes it is said to possibly, but rarely, be that it's a precursor to inappropriate behavior by male clients.
I never even knew where the adductors were. I remember when I was working out as a kid, I started out in the American Health Studios on Jamaica Avenue when I was 16. Weights. I was a weightlifter as a kid. Yeah, I was a small kid, but I built myself up pretty good after high school. I go every day. I never even knew of the adductors. I didn't know where they were. I heard of the glutes and the lats, the other standard muscles. We all worked on them, but I never heard of the adductors. That had we only known of adductors, we could have tried it on Friday night on our dates. You know what I'm saying? We could have said, "Touch me in my adductor." Where is the adductor? I didn't even. There must be one. It runs down the lower abs or something. The inside of the thigh, that's adductor work. All right, whatever, to each his own, you know. If it floats your boat and all that, I guess Al Gore gets off on having his adductors touched. But what, does anyone find this naive in a way? The point of all of this kidding is this. I mean, what's the big deal? Anyone who would be a masseuse is going to have a guy who occasionally wants what they politely call in Asia as a one-pointer, okay? There's nothing unusual about it. Secondly, if you're going to go into massage work, you're going to get the middle-aged man from time to time who hopes that you're going to give him what he... So what's the big deal? What did he really do here? I mean, I think that this is a scandal that's not a scandal, but it's a pleasant release, given that Obama is taking over America's a culture, borders, language, and culture on a daily basis.
Savage.
Living in very strange times indeed. And you have to ask yourself, when does it change? What happens? Where is the point at which the country suddenly comes back from this death spiral? Now, you might say that the women winning in California and in other states, Republican women, could be a good sign that the Tea Parties have finally had the effect. Never mind what the pimps for the Democrat Party on television say. The low life, you take a procurer of women on the lowest street in your town, and they have more honor than guys like Chris Matthews, in my opinion. How in the world can they get a job on television when they work for the Democrat Party? Right in their eyes, they see Whitman win, they see Fiorina win, and they say it's nothing. They don't count. They beat Republican men. I don't know, maybe that's the turning point. I don't expect miracles from them any more than I expected them from Scott Brown in Massachusetts. I didn't expect it because I watched too many episodes of Brotherhood on Showtime to expect more from a politician, a lifetime politician. Doesn't mean he's a bad guy. He's just part of the system. Anyone in part of the system is going to behave the way the system wants them and expects them to behave. Don't you understand that? So we see, well, they're outsiders in a way. Meg Whitman is an outsider. She's a billionaire who made her money on her own. No one gave it to her. I mean, think about it. So at least she can bring business sense to the office, all right? So let's see she wins. Let's see Fiorina knocks that hag from Brooklyn out finally. She can go back and run a girl shop on Prospect Avenue. She'd be better off than being a U.S. senator. Two Carvel stands she should have run in her life, Barbara Boxer. The most in my day a woman like Barbara Boxer ever would have had was a chain of Carvel stands. Two tops. Two. A senator for all these years. An anti-American, anti-military, anti-police senator. I can't believe it. So maybe we've seen a turning point, but we don't know it. We're too close to it. You know what I'm saying? Maybe we've seen the turning point, but we don't know it. So I have no further comments to make, Your Honor. But I would like to say in my closing argument that we are living in strange times. When we could have a man without any experience whatsoever, with no known background whatsoever, be foisted upon us as president, Your Honor, and show one incompetence after another, Your Honor, and continue to get away with it, Your Honor. It's a circus, you know. There's the left ring, there's the right ring, there's the center ring. Let's play circus music. We have the left ring. On the left. On the right. We have the left ring. We have the right ring. We have the donkey in the left ring. We have the elephant in the right ring. And in the center ring, it's none other than the circus maestro, Michael Savage. Michael in Spain, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hello, Michael. Thanks for giving all the supporters out there strength to fight this liberal agenda. I'm in probably the worst socialist country in the world, Spain, headed by Jose Luis Zapatero. He's got the political savvy of Gavin Newsom, only worse.
Well, here's the thing about Spain. It was a very fine government ruling it until the subways were bombed by the Muslims within. And let's not mince words. Muslims bombed the subways, and immediately the people capitulated. The Spanish lost their guts to fight. Isn't that true?
Absolutely. I was here when it happened. And,
The Spanish have gone from the conquistadors in stainless steel or metal suits to disco kings now?
No, just skinny socialists, you know, with their designer jeans, skinny arm vegetarian types with their little glasses, you know, want to they try to look like a Woody Allen, you know?
Oh, they're trying to have a low profile, keep their head down.
Yeah, they you know, he's a hero over here. They have statues of that pedophile over here.
Of who? Of Michael Jackson?
No, Woody Allen.
Oh, Woody Allen is a hero in Spain?
You can't believe it. You can't believe it.
That's a strange one. From a country that gave us the Inquisition to suddenly pick up on Woody Allen, that's a pretty big jump. I mean, that was a nation that invented the term Murano. You know what that is, don't you?
No, what?
The Muranos were Jews in the Middle Ages who were forced to convert to Catholicism. Otherwise, they would be tortured and killed. So many of them, on the surface, converted into Catholicism, but they practiced the religion under the surface. That they were called Muranos.
There's another term. There's another term for them. But you got to remember that there are a bunch of apologizing sad sacks now. You know, they apologize for being conquistadores. They apologize for the Inquisition. They have to they're always apologizing for the Franco years, which by the way, he saved 60,000 Jews. He allowed them into the country. Because he knew him.
That's right. I know the whole story of the Spanish Civil War. Most of the Americans that went over in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade were diehard anti-American communists. They should have been thrown out of the country before they went into the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. I actually met a few of those old rotten people in North Beach in the early days. So what are you doing stuck in the Iberian Peninsula?
Well, you know, I'm teaching English over here because I can't find work in America for the last 7 or 8 years.
So you're sort of an illegal immigrant in Spain, in Andalusia. You're in the new Andalusia. You know Andalusia, of course, as a teacher, what that is.
Yes, all Andalus. That's what they used to call
it. That's right. Have they changed the name of Spain to Andalus yet? To placate the Moors amongst them?
Well, they're trying to get rid of their patron saint, Santiago, who's the patron saint of Moor slayers. I mean, they're trying to get rid of any type of religion here, like they did back in the Republic, by the way.
The communists have long wanted to get rid of the church, and now they're doing it through political correctness.
Absolutely. And, you know, they got rid of it during the Republic, and that's why the Republic failed. You know, the whole idea of socialism, and you've said it, we all say it, it's about getting rid of foundations to destroy the society. So you're just relying on the government. That's it.
That's right. The new religion is the state. The new Messiah is the head of the state. That is why Obama is worshipped as a head of state, because they've turned him into God. They've made him into a substitute for Jesus. Do you understand that?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's right. In other words, the Christian should worship Obama instead of worshiping Jesus, because Obama represents not the church but the state. That's what communism is.
Absolutely. And you just see it. I mean, Europe is just going down the tubes. I mean, it's like...
Oh, wait a minute. The radical Muslims went down into the tubes and bombed it with some compound. I don't think that Alfred Nobel invented. They didn't use TNT.
They used plastic explosives. But now this is, you can't believe the overrunning of people from South America, Eastern Europe, Africa, North Africa, Senegal.
But is there a right-wing party in Spain that is nationalistic, that would like to see the glory of the days of the great Spain restored? Is there such a group left in that country?
Absolutely. There's a few of them left, but they got to be careful. They can't display, you'll like this, they can't display certain insignias. You can't go on Franco's birthday up to where he's buried and do certain things or say certain things. They're watching. They're filming you. I've been to Franco's.
So in other words, the leftists have turned it into a police state, a fascist police state.
Absolutely.
It's the new Soviet. It's the new Soviet Union with paella. Instead of serving borscht, they serve paella.
Absolutely.
How is the paella in Spain these days? Is it any good?
It depends on where you go. You know, if you go to certain places, they make it right. If you go to, like, a tourist place, it's complete crap. If you make it at home, you know, because they got all the components to make it with.
I make the best paella in the world. I do, because I use expensive saffron to begin with. Most paella, by the way, since we're talking about cuisine, I can't help it because I lived in Spain for a while, a very brief period. I really love the food. I actually lived in Mallorca. Arenal de Mallorca, and I used to eat in a local little restaurant. I think it was 30 pesetas for lunch. It was unbelievable. Most paella is made not with saffron, but with a cheaper substitute, which simply colors the food rather than flavors it, number one. And number two, they over-oil it. They don't cook it long enough to create that slight crust on the bottom because they're anxious to get it out of the oven. And it's too filled with butter to have a proper taste.
When I've made it before, I mean, you know, you can buy really good saffron here for a very affordable price.
Where is the saffron grown?
It grows all over Spain. I'll tell you what, that's the one good thing the Moors did do. They brought that here, actually. From the Middle East or North Africa.
The Moors also discovered coffee. Everyone forgets that the Arab conquistadors discovered coffee in Ethiopia. Everyone forgets that. That was another great addition to the world. Chairman. Thanks for listening in Spain. Michael in Spain, thank you very much. This is Michael Savage broadcasting to 400 or so radio stations, 380, 375, 400, who could count, on MPLS, multi-protocol label switching devices.
Savage.